This is on angry white men, who they are going to support. What are they going to do with Trump? Who else could lead them? 10. The media might come around once we are down to 2 or 3 candidates, unless there is a complete circus. At this point, you can't rely on the media to focus on anything related to the campaign, unless it relates to Trump. What needs to happen now with the super PAC is to focus on touching people directly face-to-face or through social media, email blasts, special events, etc. I could position Elizabeth as a talking head for the talk shows, since they are actively looking for people who can speak about Trump, the GOP, and breaking developments in the major campaigns. But it will take some time. Charles may have identified a litany of factors making the task we had set out for Jampack nigh on impossible. At the same time, as we struggled to gain any bit of traction for the messages we so desperately wanted to reach the public, Dan DeVivo reminded me to think of Jampack as an experiment. This perspective made me less prone to thinking in terms of successes and failures, and more open to appreciating whatever directions, however unexpected, toward which Jampack might lead us. 3 days after Charles presented his ominous view of the media landscape, we encountered a twist in the road when Nico House walked into our conference room. An Army veteran and political science major at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Nico had been a prominent student organizer for the Sanders campaign. His enthusiastic support of Sanders had been featured in campaign coverage appearing in, among other places, the New York Times and McClatchy. By March, however, Nico was speaking out about his belief that Hillary Clinton loyalists had infiltrated the Sanders campaign in North Carolina, and he was making videos documenting his beliefs and posting them to Facebook and YouTube. Jampack's director of social media, Danielle Underhill, came across these videos and passed them to Dan. Dan called Nico, who happened to be visiting his brother in Miami, and had been talking to a couple of independent journalists about what he had seen in North Carolina. We invited him to our office after Dan told us Nico was looking for a place where he could hold a press conference. By the time we met Nico on March 20th, 2016, the media narrative that the Democratic nomination had effectively been decided was starting to rigidify. Even though there were 2,020 of 4,051 pledged delegates still up for grabs in the remaining 3 months of primaries and caucuses, phrases like insurmountable lead had begun to filter into the media ether, principally owing to Clinton's wide margins of victory in southern states, such as Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and North and South Carolina. It was a restless and uncertain time to be a Sanders supporter. And here was Nico, a bright and ambitious volunteer organizer, sitting at our conference table and methodically explaining to two independent journalists on the phone how he had witnessed with his own eyes the infiltration of the Sanders campaign structure in North Carolina by a known Clinton loyalist. According to Nico, a Clinton acolyte had managed to become appointed as the campaign's state director, and then engaged in acts of sabotage by stymieing the campaign from engaging in organizational opportunities and receiving key endorsements. And Nico said the infiltration wasn't isolated. His own investigation had suggested there were other instances of infiltration of Sanders' campaign offices in South Carolina and Wisconsin. He was personally convinced it was widespread enough in North Carolina to have destroyed Sanders' chances there. Reports that there might be infiltration afoot with the Sanders campaign did not originate with Nico. In late December 2015, an unnamed advisor to the campaign was quoted as suggesting that the campaign's national data director, Josh Uretsky, who was fired 3 months into the job for accessing Clinton's confidential voter data from the DNC database, was a DNC plant whose actions allowed the DNC to cut off the Sanders campaign access to voter data. Nico's statement in our office, however, was singularly personal and poignant. After the press conference, I asked Nico whether in the event Sanders went on to lose the nomination, he would put the blame on the infiltration he had seen in North Carolina and uncovered elsewhere. But Nico wasn't ready to contemplate the possibility of Bernie not winning. "I'm not going to let Bernie Sanders lose this nomination," he said. "This is too important. I've just seen too much." Tears welled in Nico's eyes momentarily. And then he excitedly launched into praise for Sanders' platform on issues of race. Nico told us that if necessary, he was determined to do everything he could to convince Sanders to take legal action based on the events he had witnessed. Like Nico, at the time, we still had faith that Bernie could still pull off a victory. However insurmountable the odds were purported to be by this point. As for Nico's investigation, we thought it might make a compelling subject for a jam-packed video series, with potential significance even beyond the 2016 presidential contest. Dan had a trailer edited, and we established a crowdfunding page. While obsessively following the remaining primary contests, I ruminated for a bit on possible legal theories based on alleged infiltration of the Sanders campaign by Clinton loyalists. After searching around, I found a helpful legal treatise on federal election law crimes on the Justice Department website and gave a copy to Nico, who had served as a paralegal in the Army, to get his thoughts. It wasn't until June 15, 2016, which happened to be the day after the last primary in the District of Columbia, that I saw a legal pathway begin to take shape. By then, there had been widespread reports of irregularities at the polls, including in Arizona, California, New York, and Puerto Rico, among other places. The concept of this being a rigged election had already started to germinate in discussions among Sanders supporters. But on that day in particular, a publicly accessible WordPress blog was established under the name Guccifer 2.0, who took credit for having hacked the DNC's servers, and released a series of DNC documents. Among them was a memorandum addressed to the Democratic National Committee and dated May 26, 2015, the May 26th memo. Upon reading through the May 26th memo for the first time, it struck me as the kind of hot document I was trained to spot as a first-year lawyer, when I was tasked with reviewing the copious email files of a group of executives at a large San Diego software company being sued for securities fraud. As part of that assignment, I had to flag any emails or documents which might be used to show that the company's leadership had knowledge that its accountants were improperly booking and inflating its publicly reported revenues. From a litigation perspective, such pieces of evidence are especially valuable, given the well-known difficulty of proving the scienter element for claims sounding in fraud. The May 26 memo, however, constituted not just direct evidence of knowledge that the nominating process was being rigged for Hillary Clinton, but itself was a kind of blueprint for accomplishing the rigging. We will look at this and other internal DNC documents in closer detail in Act One. But to summarize, even before Bernie Sanders had announced his candidacy, this single memorandum, which just happened to be one of the documents released by Guccifer 2.0 on June 15th, explicitly laid out how the DNC would work directly with the mainstream media to advance Clinton through the nomination process via a tripartite strategy of what the author categorized as 1. Reporter outreach, stories with no fingerprints, 2. Releases on social media, and 3. Bracketing events. In Act 1, we will further explore the true meaning of these strategic concepts, which worked to ensure that the nomination would go to Hillary Clinton. Based on my professional experience as a business litigator, it seemed like the equivalent of a report to a corporation's leadership explaining how the company should go about falsifying its sales data. Clear and direct evidence of fraud like the May 26th memo may be rare, but it is not sufficient to bring a legal claim in court. That requires a plaintiff in addition to a viable cause of action. The plaintiff must have a sufficient stake in the matter to pursue a claim, what the law calls standing, and there must be an actionable legal theory. It is not enough to identify something as wrong or illegal, but the conduct in question must be capable of being described in terms of a recognized category of legal claims. Perhaps it was due to my own background in civil litigation, having first dealt with the possibility of smoking gun documents in the context of a massive securities fraud case. But what flashed in my mind upon considering the questions of plaintiffs and legal theory was an analogy to the typical securities fraud class action. In such cases, The plaintiffs are the company's shareholders, those who are injured by the company's misrepresentations because they have participated in the market for the company's stock, which they purchased at an inflated price. But the DNC, while it is a corporation, doesn't sell stock. It functions in the political market. And in the political market, as the Supreme Court has ensured through its holding in Citizens United, the most privileged form of participation is the giving of money to political campaigns. Analogy aside, from the vantage point of bringing a legally viable case based on the rigged primaries, it seemed that the best candidates to serve as plaintiffs were those who participated in the process as political donors. Indeed, the law has always recognized the loss of money as one of the classic instances giving rise to legal standing. The analogy to securities fraud also suggested general causes of action to assert. A typical securities fraud case will plead claims based on material misrepresentations or omissions of the company. The plaintiff shareholders can also plead claims for breach of fiduciary duty against the company's officers and directors. I believe that the conduct of the DNC and its then chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, can readily be described according to these legal claims. By the time Guccifer 2.0 published the May 26 memo, the DNC and Wasserman Schultz had already proclaimed their neutrality multiple times in the mainstream press. Moreover, the Democratic Party's own charter and bylaws, which I was able to locate on the Internet without too much trouble, governed the DNC and explicitly required it, and its officers and staff, to exercise and maintain impartiality and even-handedness during the nominating process. We will examine the meaning of the charter and bylaws in further details in Acts 1 and 2. Suffice it to say, the mandate to act in a fair and even-handed manner with respect to the primaries is rather explicit, and it had been acknowledged by DNC officers publicly with respect to events in the 2016 primaries. By claiming it was acting in a neutral manner, the DNC was both painting a false picture and hiding the truth of the matter, that the organization was determinedly working to advance Hillary Clinton to the nomination from the get-go. The May 26 memo confirmed that. Every claim based on fraud or misrepresentation must satisfy the element of injury. In this case, there was tangible injury in the form of over $200 million paid by donors to the Bernie Sanders campaign. Many of these donors paid small amounts, the $27 donation of Sanders' famous rallying cry, which made the case tailor-made for a class action. And I firmly believe these donors have one very important thing in common. They never would have paid that money had they known the truth of just how rigged our political system is. I firmly believe this because of the experience Elizabeth and I had as Bernie donors and supporters. Before the 2016 election, we believed what we had been taught in school about the fundamental democratic character of America's political institutions. Before the light began to trickle in with Nico's visit to our office, along with the reports of rigging in the primaries, and then a whole bright ray of light with the release of documents by Guccifer 2.0 and WikiLeaks, our faith in the essential democratic character of America's political institutions had fueled our creation of JANPAC, its work in support of Sanders, and our own financial contributions to his campaign. When we began to learn just how far the DNC had gone to ensure Clinton would be the nominee, Elizabeth and I felt like victims of a massive Ponzi scheme. And we would learn in due course that we were not alone, not by a long shot. When Elizabeth posted to the JANPAC Facebook page and website that Beck and Lee was conducting an investigation of possible legal claims against the DNC for rigging the primaries, the response was overwhelming. Our office became inundated with thousands of messages, emails, and calls from people around the country who supported Bernie Sanders and felt that the primary was a sham. Many of them had given money to the campaign, and when we spoke or emailed with them, they sounded no different from the typical victim of fraud, desperately seeking a legal remedy. The group of folks who consulted with us wanting to sue the DNC was a real cross-section of the country. They hailed from every state, as well as from diverse socioeconomic backgrounds. Among those who had contacted us were lawyers and doctors who had donated the maximum $2,700 each to the campaign, alongside folks on fixed incomes who had reached into their retirement accounts for a few hundred dollars, to the average donor of $27, as well as homeless people who had reached into their pockets for a few dollars. All of them had believed in American democracy and in the real possibility of Sanders becoming president, and all of them were mistaken. We discussed the possibility of filing a case against the DNC with our trusted colleagues, Tony Hernandez and Colin O'Brien. Once they came on board as co-counsel, we circulated contingency class action retainer agreements to multitudes of folks who were contacting us at all hours of the day, wanting to hire our firms to pursue legal actions against the DNC. On June 28, 2016, Carol Wilding et al. V. DNC Services Corporation, DBA, Democratic National Committee, and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Case number 16-CV-61511-WJZ, Southern District, Florida, often referred to as the DNC fraud lawsuit, was filed in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida. The complaint was brought in the names of 120 representative plaintiffs. Our lead, or first-name plaintiff, Carol Wilding, also just happened to live in Broward County, and against the DNC and its chair, and alleged claims for fraud, negligent misrepresentation, statutory unlawful trade practices, unjust enrichment, breach of fiduciary duty, and negligence. It strives to succinctly explain how the DNC and Wasserman Schultz violated the charter commitment to neutrality in the presidential nominating process based on the facts as known at the time. Attached to the complaint as Exhibit 1 is the May 26 memo. The case has received very little attention in the mainstream media, and this was especially true in the early going. But from the outset, and as an offshoot of JAMPAC's original commitment to cultivating social media forms of communication, there has been an active social media presence centered around the lawsuit, its objectives, and related issues, with key nodal points including the lawsuit's Facebook and Twitter accounts, as well as our own personal accounts. To find the most striking visible manifestation of the lawsuit's social media presence, one might look to the events of July 1, 2016. On that afternoon, the complaint and summons were delivered at the DNC's headquarters in Washington, D.C., by a young man named Sean Lucas, who was hired by One Source Process, Inc., One Source, the Washington, D.C. legal services company we retained to serve the initial process. While the case had only been filed with the court 3 days earlier, there was already burgeoning interest in the lawsuit on social media, and Elizabeth came up with the idea of live-streaming the serving of process on Facebook in order to enable our clients and any other potential class members and interested members of the public to witness the moment when the DNC and Wasserman Schultz would become subject to the jurisdiction of the court. As such, hundreds of viewers tuned in live to watch JAMPAC filmmaker Ricardo Villalba record Sean as he entered the imposing DNC building, legal papers in hand. Those who have watched the video, whether live or among the almost million who have viewed it since, witnessed Ricardo tell his audience that the DNC was about to be served with legal papers. Ricardo then walks across the street and meets Sean outside the headquarters. They enter together. Sean tells the guard at the security desk that they have legal papers to serve. The guard takes Sean's ID card and proceeds to enter data into a computer. At this point, while waiting for the guard to complete the check-in process, Ricardo and Sean have an animated discussion, where both express how happy they are about serving the DNC. Ricardo says that, "We're very excited because I feel like we're going to push the Democratic Party to," and Sean completes the sentence with, "do the right thing." After a few minutes, three additional security guards approach the desk. One asks Ricardo if he is taking video. Ricardo responds that he is live-streaming to Facebook. She requests that he stop recording. Another guard, an older male, approaches, points directly at Ricardo while exclaiming, "I need you to turn that off." When Ricardo questions why, the guard circles out from behind the desk and gets right next to Sean and Ricardo. "We don't allow cameras in this building," he tells them. A heated debate ensues, and eventually Sean and Ricardo are told that they have to get pre-approval from the proper people in order to film on the premises. At this point, Ricardo notes that there are now over 300 viewers watching live on Facebook. He lets the audience know that he has to stop live streaming because they must go through the necessary procedures. He apologizes, and the camera shuts off. When the live stream resumes, the camera is angled up at the security desk. Ricardo appears to be in a seated position while filming surreptitiously. Sean informs the audience that contact has been made and there is someone on the way down to receive us. While they wait, Sean and Ricardo engage in quiet discussion. Sean tells Ricardo that he volunteered to be the process server for one source in this case. Doing this job, Sean says, is like his birthday, Christmas, and Canada Day, all coming together at the same time. Eventually, a woman emerges from the vestibule, visible behind the security desk. She turns in their direction, and Sean and Ricardo rise to greet her. Sean shakes her hand, and she introduces herself as Becca, with the DNC upstairs. Sean proceeds to hand Becca separate packages for the DNC and Wasserman Schultz with the words, "You guys have been served. See you in court." Becca takes them, responding, "Perfect and okay," and walks back to the vestibule. Once outside, Sean and Ricardo are plainly jubilant. "That was probably the most gratifying thing I've ever done," says Sean. "Democracy has prevailed today." The sentiments are echoed in many viewer Facebook comments from that day. For example, "Happy 4th, a chance for democracy. OMG, 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 power to the people, burners. Let's hope something good comes out of this." In the practice of litigation, service of process is typically a routine matter, especially when the recipient is a large organization. Before this case, I couldn't recall a time when a large corporate defendant had made service an issue in court. The great enthusiasm exhibited by the public in witnessing Sean and Ricardo serve the DNC, and their own enthusiasm in carrying out this otherwise mundane legal task, made me realize that this lawsuit was going to be like no other. Still, all of us on the plaintiff's legal team were surprised when, on July 22, 2016, the defendants filed a motion to dismiss the case based on insufficient process, a request making the contention that Sean had not served the correct DNC employee. Not only are such motions exceedingly rare, but we had something almost never available with respect to the issue of service. That is, video evidence, which showed unequivocally that the DNC had sent an employee named Becca down to receive the legal papers from Sean, who told her he had legal papers for both defendants, whereupon Becca accepted them, saying, "Perfect." There was no mention from Becca that she was unauthorized to accept legal service on behalf of the DNC or Wasserman Schultz. Nonetheless, the defendants filed a memorandum arguing that Becca, whose full name is Rebecca Harries, was a mere special assistant and was never authorized to receive legal papers. It attached an affidavit from Harries acknowledging that she had received the papers from two men who were refusing to leave, but because it was the Friday right before the 4th of July weekend, there was no one in the office with actual authority to accept the papers. The legal team conferred and began to prepare a response. In addition to making the court aware of the video evidence, which was posted on Facebook and YouTube, Cullen suggested we obtain a sworn declaration from the process server. We were in the process of drafting one up for Sean's review when the unthinkable happened. I got news of Sean Lucas's death on August 3, 2016. It first came through social media. I bolted up from my chair and yelled in the direction of Elizabeth's office, "Someone's telling me the DNC process server is dead." After some loud, rapid discussion, Elizabeth found the number for one source in D.C. and placed a call. The terrible news was true. A shaken Brandon Yoshimura, the owner of one source who had given Sean the DNC job, confirmed that Sean had been found dead the day before. At the time, with no other details available, it seemed impossible that the young man whose contagious enthusiasm lit up our Facebook and YouTube pages just a month earlier was suddenly no longer with us. Further clouding the mood was the fact that on the day we received the news that Sean was dead, there was already an atmosphere of considerable tension surrounding the DNC fraud lawsuit, outside of the degree which might be considered normal for major litigation. Just 24 days earlier, the DNC's voter expansion data director, 27-year-old Seth Rich, had been shot dead on the street outside his D.C. apartment. While Rich's murder was initially characterized by the police as a botched robbery, even though his possessions, including a wallet, wristwatch, and phone, were left on the body, there was almost immediate speculation that Rich had been responsible for leaking the internal DNC emails published by WikiLeaks, and that he had been assassinated as a result. Over 18 months later, Rich's murder remains unsolved, although the mainstream media has clung stubbornly to the official narrative that he died in a mugging gone wrong. At the same time, evidence suggesting Rich was connected to the documents published by WikiLeaks, as well as unanswered questions pertaining to this evidence, have mounted. Within a day of Sean's death, Elizabeth was able to obtain a police report from the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, which indicated that Sean's girlfriend had found him lying unconscious on his bathroom floor on August 2nd, shortly after 7 p.m. We filed it with the court, along with a legal memorandum opposing the defendant's motion to dismiss the case. In our opposition memorandum, we advised the court of the video taken on July 1st, which showed Sean handing the legal papers to the DNC staffer sent downstairs to receive them. Now that Sean was no longer alive, and therefore obviously unable to provide his own sworn testimony about what transpired, the video would have to suffice as evidence of proper service. Upon receiving the opposition papers, which contained the notice of our process server's sudden death, Judge William S. Zlock promptly issued an order scheduling an evidentiary hearing. Judge Zlock set the hearing for August 23, 2016, at 11 o'clock a.m. in his courtroom in Fort Lauderdale. He advised the parties to be prepared to present testimony and or physical evidence regarding the defendant's motion to dismiss for failure to make proper service. That left us with 2 weeks to gather all the evidence we needed and make arrangements for any necessary witnesses. We had the video, of course, but we also required witness testimony to authenticate the video. Ricardo Villalba was understandably nervous in the wake of Sean's death, but agreed to come down from D.C. for the hearing. Lead named plaintiff Carol Wilding, a retired flight attendant who lived nearby and had watched the service of process on livestream TV while it was happening, also agreed to testify if necessary. In addition, we wanted to present any evidence to rebut the DNC's contention that Rebecca Harries was just a lowly assistant, not authorized to receive legal papers. By that time, of course, WikiLeaks had published a significant quantity of internal DNC emails, which our legal team began to scour. A hearing on the technical issue of proper service is not generally the type of legal proceeding one would expect to pack in the galleries, but this case was an exception. Judge Zlock's small courtroom became crammed with riveted spectators, who watched each side make their presentations. Cullen, who is the most accomplished and versatile courtroom lawyer on our team, led the charge for the plaintiffs. A large chunk of the nearly two-hour hearing was spent playing the video, and then eliciting testimony from Ricardo on the relevant events. The defendant's lead attorney, Bruce Spiva, spent no time attacking the admissibility of the video or Ricardo's testimony, although on cross-examination, he tried to raise eyebrows about the fact that Ricardo filmed the event surreptitiously after the DNC's guards had ordered him to stop. On redirect, Ricardo gave the following response to Spiva's insinuation he had done something wrong by live-streaming that day. "As a filmmaker, I believe that it was necessary to document this event, not just for me, but also for the audience that we have. Prior to tuning out the live streaming, we had over 300 viewers, and I needed to bring closures to them. At the same time, Mr. Lucas and I had a conversation. The building, the DNC building, has several cameras. They videotape us going into the building. They videotape us approaching the building. So there's a lot of cameras in the building as well. So I felt that it was necessary for us to continue videotaping. I didn't see any sign saying that I couldn't videotape. When I first walked in, none of the officers, the first security officers, saw me videotaping. They didn't say nothing. This happened after the other supervisors came out. The reason why I couldn't videotape? I felt it wasn't reading law or reading rule. I felt they were just making things up, and that's the reason why they asked me to stop. Spivey's main complaint at the hearing was a technical one. Even though the video clearly depicted Harry's accepting legal papers on behalf of the DNC and Wasserman Schultz from Sean, after he had advised the security desk exactly what he was there to do, she was just a low-level employee who was never authorized to receive them. In response, Cullen pointed out that the defendants hadn't even bothered to bring Harry's to the hearing to testify, and that the declaration she submitted with the motion to dismiss contained material contradictions with the video. He also disputed the idea that she was just a low-level employee, proffering an email from WikiLeaks showing her title to be Special Assistant to the CEO Democratic National Committee, in which she invited the entire DNC staff to an afternoon meeting in the Wasserman conference room. Observing the proceedings from plaintiff's counsel table, I sensed a tense but solemn atmosphere in the room which belied the banality of the precise legal issue being addressed. During the hearing itself, Judge Locke, who stoically oversaw the proceedings from the bench, commented that this was a case of magnitude. Many, if not most, of the spectators either considered themselves to be proposed class members or supported Sanders in ways other than donating money, and the nomination of Hillary Clinton had formally occurred just 1 month earlier in Philadelphia. That and the sudden resignation of Wasserman Schultz as DNC chair on the eve of the convention were still fresh in their minds. A number approached us before the hearing, as well as during breaks and afterward, thanking us for taking on the case. Their demeanor was uniformly grave, even sad, but focused on the proceedings at hand. Joe Kreps, a senior advisor to law professor Tim Canova's unsuccessful grassroots campaign to unseat Wasserman Schultz from Congress, shook my hand while looking especially glum. 8 months later, I was back in Judge Locke's courtroom. The service of process issue having been resolved, I was again seated at the plaintiff's counsel table, watching the DNC's counsel make new arguments for dismissing the case. The court had scheduled the hearing in response to the defendant's second motion to dismiss complaint, which proffered a whole new slew of grounds for why Judge Locke should throw out the case without even getting to the discovery phase. That is, the process by which litigants accumulate potential evidence through such discovery tools as document requests and depositions. Among them was the contention that courts should not intrude in cases involving mere political promises. The defendants compared the promise of neutrality in the Democratic Party's charter to George H.W. Bush's notorious broken campaign promise of "Read my lips, no new taxes," arguing that if Sanders' donors have standing to bring suit, so too would have Bush's donors. Spiva has been going over this line of reasoning with Judge Locke, warning the court that it should not wade into the political thicket. Now the judge alluded to the example of Bush, previously argued by the defendants in their moving papers. The court: is there a difference between a campaign promise made by a political candidate and a promise that pertains to the integrity of the primary process itself? In other words, President George H.W. Bush's "Mr. Spiva, read my lips." The court: promise, read my lips, no new taxes, and then he raised taxes. Well, he could not be sued for raising taxes. But with respect to the DNC charter, Article 5, Section 4, is there a difference between the two? Mr. Spiva: not one. There's obviously a difference in degree. I think, Your Honor, I don't want to overreach and say that there's no difference, but I don't think there's a difference that's material in terms of how the court should decide the question before it in terms of standing, and that this, again, goes to how the party runs itself, how it decides who it's going to associate with, how it decides how it's going to choose its standard-bearer ultimately. In case after case, from O'Brien to Wims to Wisconsin v. La Follette, Cousins v. Wagoda, the Supreme Court and other courts have affirmed the party's right to make that determination. Those are internal issues that the party gets to decide basically without interference from the courts. And the fact that money has... I know that my distinguished colleague on the other side has several times said that, well, money makes this difference. And it really doesn't in this context. You know, again, If you had a charity where somebody said, hey, I'm going to take this money and use it for a specific purpose, X, and they pocketed it and stole the money, of course that's different. But here, where you have a party that's saying, we're going to, you know, choose our standard bearer, and we're going to follow these general rules of the road, which we are voluntarily deciding, we could have, and we could have voluntarily decided that, look, we're going to go into back rooms like they used to do, and smoke cigars and pick the candidate that way. That's not the way it was done, but they could have, and that would have also been their right. And it would drag the court well into party politics, internal party politics, to answer those questions. In his response to Judge Locke's question, loaded with the image of Tammany Hall-esque figures smoking cigars, Spiva only confirmed what we, our clients, and so many of Sanders' supporters have felt in our guts for months, that the DNC's obligation to be neutral is a sham, making the primaries a sham as well. To hear the DNC's lawyer admit this fact in open court was still shocking, though. When it was my turn to speak, I rose and told Judge Locke that if what Spiva has said is true, then I think it's a really sad day for democracy in this country. Because what essentially the DNC has now stated in a court of law is that it believes that there is no enforceable obligation to run the primary elections of this country's democracy in a fair and impartial manner. One does not typically see lawyers defending multi-million-dollar corporations from fraud claims get up in court to proclaim that their clients have no obligation to follow the commitment set forth in their governing documents. Yet that was precisely the tactic adopted by Spiva at the hearing. And it was not the only jarring or unexpected statement of the day. At one point, he suggested that our case could never be certified as a class action because donors to the Sanders campaign would have still given money to him, indeed been more likely to donate had they known the process was rigged. At another, Spiva told Judge Locke there was no way for the court to even define what the charter means by even-handed and impartial. Such terms weren't the only key components of our case incapable of definition, according to Spiva. Earlier in the hearing, he had suggested it would be impossible for the court to define who is a member of the Democratic Party nationwide. At the start of his presentation, Spiva even accused our lawsuit of being a political weapon against the DNC and its former chairperson, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and that we were the ones threatening some serious First Amendment injury to the defendants. Spiva's brazen comments felt like a form of gaslighting, a psychological tactic to distract from the core legal arguments at issue that long afternoon. But the comment about smoking cigars in back rooms was like a punch in the gut, an in-your-face statement by Spiva that his clients would say and do as they pleased, and there was nothing we, our clients, or anyone else could do about it. My closing comments to Judge Locke reflected the foreboding feeling I was having at the time, as I noted that if Spiva were right, that there was no legal remedy for the DNC having rigged the primaries, then that's a really dire road for this country to be on. If people participating in the political process who get defrauded as a result, such as Sanders' campaign donors, can have no relief, then the prospects for democracy in this country are dark indeed. In the thick of Judge Locke's brief parting remarks before adjourning the hearing came a second proposition about the nation's democracy. Democracy demands the truth so people can make intelligent decisions. I can tell you that Judge Locke's words were ringing in my ears as I left the courthouse that day, and ever since, from time to time, they re-enter my mind. I will have more to say about the progress of the lawsuit in my summation, where I will try to assess the evidence presented and draw some conclusions. But for now, it is time to dive into the question at hand. What happened to Bernie Sanders? Act 1. Stories with No Fingerprints. On April 30th, 2015, the senior senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, announced his candidacy for the Democratic nomination for president. But while the Iowa caucus was still 10 months away, his fate in the Democratic Party's nominating process, along with those of all of its contestants, was already sealed. Just 1 week prior to Sanders' announcement, an email had circulated among a group of Hillary Clinton campaign strategists, including campaign manager John Podesta, scheduling a conference call. There were to be 3 agenda items, including a DNC plan. Attached to the email was the following memorandum addressed to the Democratic National Committee. To the Democratic National Committee. Re. 2016 GOP Presidential Candidates. Date, April 7, 2015. Friends, this memo is intended to outline the strategy and goals a potential Hillary Clinton presidential campaign would have regarding the 2016 Republican presidential field. Clearly, most of what is contained in this memo is work the DNC is already doing. This exercise is intended to put those ideas to paper. Our goals and strategy. Our hope is that the goal of a potential HRC campaign and the DNC would be one in the same. To make whomever the Republicans nominate unpalatable to a majority of the electorate. We have outlined 3 strategies to obtain our goal. 1. Force all Republican candidates to lock themselves into extreme conservative positions that will hurt them in a general election. 2. Undermine any credibility/trust Republican presidential candidates have to make inroads to our coalition or independence. 3. Muddy the waters on any potential attack lodged against HRC. Operationalizing the strategy. Pied Piper candidates. There are 2 ways to approach the strategies mentioned above. The first is to use the field as a whole to inflict damage on itself similar to what happened to Mitt Romney in 2012. The variety of candidates is a positive here, and many of the lesser known can serve as a cudgel to move the more established candidates further to the right. In this scenario, we don't want to marginalize the more extreme candidates, but make them more Pied Piper candidates who actually represent the mainstream of the Republican Party. Pied Piper candidates include, but aren't limited to, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, Ben Carson. We need to be elevating the Pied Piper candidates so that they are leaders of the pack and tell the press to take them seriously. Undermining their message and credibility. Most of the more established candidates will want to focus on building a winning general election coalition. The Pied Pipers of the field will mitigate this to a degree. But more will need to be done on certain candidates to undermine their credibility among our coalition. Communities of color, millennials, women, and independent voters. In this regard, the goal here would be to show that they are just the same as every other GOP candidate, extremely conservative on these issues. Some examples. Jeb Bush. What to undermine? The notion he is a moderate or concerned about regular Americans. Perceived inroads with the Latino population. Marco Rubio. What to undermine? The idea he has fresh ideas. His perceived appeal to Latinos. Scott Walker. What to undermine? The idea he can rally working and middle-class Americans. Rand Paul. What to undermine? The idea he is a different kind of Republican. His stance on the military and his appeal to millennials and communities of color. Bobby Jindal. What to undermine? His new ideas. Chris Christie. What to undermine? He tells it like it is. Muddying the waters. As we all know, the right-wing attack machine has been building its opposition research on Hillary Clinton for decades. The RNC, et al., has been telegraphing they are ready to attack, and do so with reckless abandon. One way we can respond to these attacks is to show how they boomerang onto the Republican presidential field. The goal, then, is to have a dossier on the GOP candidates on the likely attacks HRC will face. Based on attacks that have already occurred, the areas they are highlighting, transparency and disclosure, donors and associations, management and business dealings. In this regard, Any information on scandals or ethical lapses on the GOP candidates would serve well. We won't be picky. Again, we think our goals mirror those of the DNC. We look forward to continuing the conversation. Two aspects of the memorandum stand out. First, and as a predicate to defining the DNC's strategy, the memo articulates the hope that the goal of a potential Hillary Rodham Clinton campaign and the DNC would be one in the same. While the document goes on to discuss matters of DNC strategy in relation to candidates for the Republican nomination, the significance of this identity of purpose between the DNC and the Clinton campaign cannot go underemphasized. For one, as a legal matter, the proposition contradicts the charter and bylaws of the Democratic Party, the legal document which governs the conduct of the DNC during the nominating process. To quote Article 5, Section 4 of the Charter, "The national chairperson shall serve full time and shall receive such compensation as may be determined by agreement between the chairperson and the Democratic National Committee. In the conduct and management of the affairs and procedures of the Democratic National Committee, particularly as they apply to the preparation and conduct of the presidential nominating process, the chairperson shall exercise impartiality and even-handedness as between the presidential candidates and campaigns. The chairperson shall be responsible for ensuring that the national officers and staff of the Democratic National Committee maintain impartiality and even-handedness during the Democratic Party presidential nominating process." Emphasis added. There is no way to read this provision other than as requiring the DNC to maintain a neutral posture with respect to the candidates for the nomination. The mere suggestion that the goal of a potential Hillary Rodham Clinton campaign and the DNC would be one in the same violates the charter obligation of the DNC on its face. Of further significance is what the memo offers regarding its stated purpose of making whomever the Republicans nominate unpalatable to the majority of the electorate. On this point, it sets forth what has become known as the DNC's Pied Piper strategy. That is, elevating the extreme candidates in the GOP field for purpose of stacking the general election contest in its favor. The memo names Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, and Ben Carson as examples of Pied Piper candidates. How to elevate these candidates? The Clinton campaign's message to the DNC is blunt. Tell the press to take them seriously. Again, the memo postulates the proper role of the DNC as something other than running the primaries in an impartial and even-handed manner. But not only is it improper for the DNC to have a unity of purpose with the Hillary Clinton campaign, the latter is now directing the DNC to elevate the status of specified extreme GOP candidates in the public perception. In other words, the memo orders the DNC to shape the mainstream media landscape in whatever manner maximally benefits the Clinton campaign, presenting the Pied Piper strategy as one specific avenue for accomplishing this goal. On May 26, 2015, approximately 1 month after Sanders announced his candidacy, a second memorandum was addressed to the Democratic National Committee. This one stamped with a confidential watermark. It is reproduced in full below. 2. The Democratic National Committee. Re. 2016 GOP Presidential Candidates. Date, May 26, 2015. Below. Please find a suggested strategy for positioning and public messaging around the 2016 Republican presidential field. Ultimately, we need two. Our goals and strategy. Our goals in the coming months will be to frame the Republican field and the eventual nominee early, and to provide a contrast between the GOP field and HRC. Over the long term, these efforts will be aimed at getting us the best matchup in the general election, and weakening the eventual nominee through the course of the primary. We have outlined three strategies to obtain our goal. 1. Highlight when GOP candidates are outside of the mainstream on key issues, ideally driving the rest of the field to follow with positions that will hurt them in a general election. 2. Damage Republican presidential candidates' credibility with voters by looking for targeted opportunities to undermine their specific messaging. 3. Use specific hits to muddy the waters around ethics, transparency, and campaign finance attacks on HRC. Operationalizing the strategy, highlighting extreme or unpopular positions. There are two ways to approach the strategies mentioned above. The first is to use the field as a whole to inflict damage on itself, similar to what happened to Mitt Romney in 2012. The variety and volume of candidates is a positive here, and many of the lesser known can serve as a cudgel to move the more established candidates further to the right. In this scenario, we don't want to marginalize the more extreme candidates, but make them more Pied Piper candidates who actually represent the mainstream of the Republican Party. In these issues, we would elevate statements and policies from any candidate, including second and third tier candidates, on issues that will make them seem too far to the right on social issues and too far from the priorities of everyday Americans on economic issues. Undermining their message and credibility, based on our general election priorities. In addition to pinning down the field on key issues, we will work to undermine the Republican candidate's specific messaging, while keeping in mind which candidates and which messages we believe are most powerful. These messages and the responses to them will change, given new campaign positioning and new learnings from polling and research. But on these issues, we will keep the focus on the most likely candidates to allow some possibility for growth with the weaker candidates. Jeb Bush, what to undermine. The notion he is a moderate or concerned about regular Americans, perceived inroads with the Latino population. Marco Rubio, what to undermine. The idea he has fresh ideas, his perceived appeal to Latinos and younger voters. Scott Walker, what to undermine. His Wisconsin record, particularly on jobs, the idea he can rally working and middle-class Americans. Rand Paul, what to undermine. The idea he is a different kind of Republican, his stance on the military, and his appeal to millennials and communities of color. Chris Christie, what to undermine. His success as governor, his hypocrisy in telling it like it is, versus his ethical issues and acts of a typical politician. Muddying the waters. As we all know, the right-wing attack machine has been building its opposition research on Hillary Clinton for decades. HRC's critics have been telegraphing they are ready to attack and do so with reckless abandon. While reporters have much less of an appetite for ethics stories about GOP candidates, we will utilize the research to place highly targeted hits. For example, GOP candidates taking positions supported by their major super PAC donors. Tactics. Working with the DNC and allied groups, we will use several different methods to land these attacks, including reporter outreach. Working through the DNC and others, we should use background briefings, prep with reporters for interviews with GOP candidates, off-the-record conversations, and oppo pitches to help pitch stories with no fingerprints and utilize reporters to drive a message. Releases and social media. Where appropriate, these attacks can be leveraged for more public release, particularly the attacks around specific issues, where a public release can point out that Republicans are outside of the mainstream. Bracketing events. Both the DNC and outside groups are looking to do events and press surrounding Republican events to insert our messaging into their press and to force them to answer questions around key issues. We look forward to discussing this strategy further. Our goal is to use this conversation to answer the questions, who do we want to run against, and how best to leverage other candidates to maneuver them into the right place. Like the one circulated to the DNC on April 7th, the May 26th memo articulates the goal of the DNC as advancing Clinton's candidacy, starting with the primaries. From this vantage point, The DNC's task is to wage battle on Clinton's behalf from day one, to frame the Republican field and the eventual nominee early, and to provide a contrast between the GOP field and HRC. Emphasis added. By fighting for Clinton in the primaries, the DNC will facilitate getting us the best matchup in the general election and weakening the eventual nominee through the course of the primary. Absent from both the April 7th and May 26th memoranda is any discussion of how the stated strategic goals for the DNC could possibly square with the DNC's obligation under its own charter to maintain impartiality and even-handedness during the Democratic Party presidential nominating process. In actuality, they are diametrically opposed. The DNC could not possibly pursue a media strategy tailored to the goals of the Clinton campaign while maintaining a neutral posture with respect to the Democratic primary candidates. As seen, the April 7th memo makes the DNC's wholesale disregard of its responsibility to be neutral quite explicit when it asserts that the goal of a potential HRC campaign and the DNC would be one in the same. Upon reaffirming the role of the DNC as an arm of the Clinton campaign, the May 26th memo reiterates the Pied Piper strategy. The urgency of serving as an attack vehicle for Clinton during the primaries is underscored when the memo's author notes that the right-wing attack machine has been building its opposition research on Hillary Clinton for decades, and HRC's critics have been telegraphing they are ready to attack and do so with reckless abandon. It then goes on to describe tactics within the overall media strategy under the headings reporter outreach, releases and social media, and bracketing events. These three sets of tactics might be regarded as the channels or vehicles by which the desired media narratives are to be created. Reporter outreach encompasses direct use of reporters with the aim of generating stories with no fingerprints, narratives that do not bear indications of authorship by the DNC, but would have the appearance of news generated organically via the conventional practice of journalism. Tellingly, the memo regards reporters as assets to be utilized for the purpose of injecting narrative into media. Release and social media also describes narrative creation by the DNC, but the narrative is then subject to public release, that is, disseminated via the DNC's own voice. Bracketing events denotes the formation of narratives through staging of events by the DNC and outside groups, with the ultimate goal of inserting our messaging into their Republican press. Taken together, the two DNC memos depict a network of power operating by and between the Clinton campaign, DNC, and mainstream media that would work to ensure Bernie Sanders could not win the Democratic nomination, and which was activated even before Sanders announced his candidacy. To be sure, the name Bernie Sanders appears nowhere in the documents. However, Sanders' literal invisibility only reflects the invisibility of his significance with respect to the primaries themselves. Sanders, the candidate, was a non-person, given that the goal of a potential HRC campaign and the DNC would be one in the same. There was simply no room for an alternative viable candidate when the overarching purpose of the DNC was to elevate Hillary Clinton to the presidency. The fate of Sanders as a presidential candidate took shape in the absence of his name. The strategy outlined in these memos was destined to elevate Clinton to the nomination, because the Clinton campaign and DNC could rely on the American mainstream media to be dependable allies and assets. To see why, it is necessary to view the events of 2016 against a more general understanding of the role and function of the mainstream media in the present-day United States. In his landmark analysis of the American media industry, the late Ben Bagdikian, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and dean of the University of California at Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, reported the extraordinary fact that by 2003, five global dimension firms, operating with many of the characteristics of a cartel, owned most of the newspapers, magazines, book publishers, motion picture studios, and radio and television stations in the United States. as a consequence of these exceptionally tight compression of media assets in the hands of essentially five individuals, the American mainstream news media has come to concern itself principally with the production of news narratives favorable to a narrow band of corporate interests. At the